This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Mark Kermode, good afternoon.
That sounds so surprised.
No sport. Well, it's.
No, we're not at a sporting event.
We're not at a sporting event.
No, where's the cricket? Where's the tennis? Where's the stuff?
Well, there is stuff going on.
Is there?
Pat Murphy is watching Australia play Northampton. We could have gone there.
Really? How are Northamptonshire holding up against the Antipodeans?
Well, they haven't batted yet. I think Australia was 63 for 2 last time. But there's an awful lot of rain.
Really?
Yeah.
Was the going good to firm?
Very spongy.
Okay.
I think. I just want
that
to
was what. Eddie is. Sorry, I have to mention this. There's been a lot of debate recently about the first words said when man first stood on the moon. You know, moon is out in the cinema, and it was the 40th anniversary of the moon landing. And the famous thing is that what he meant to say was, it's one small step for a man, but great leap for mankind, giant leap for mankind. And in fact, when you listen to the tape, it sounds like he says one small step for man. And for ages and ages, people have been saying that, in fact, he had said a man, but it wasn't heard because there was a blip in the transmission. And then the sort of NASA scientists went back and listened to it again on the 40th and said, no, it absolutely, there is no blip in the transmission. He definitely said one small step for man, but he obviously meant to say one small step for a man, but he misspoke. And Eddie Izzard did a sketch about it in which he was saying, you know, it's what everyone said, it was meant to be spontaneous, but of course it wasn't spontaneous, because if you said what the first thing that came into your mind when you landed on the moon, it'd probably be, oh, it's all spongy.
Now that would have been a good clip. That would have been worth.
Is that what we would have had, that, you know, all the time that this 40th anniversary ends, and Neil Armstrong, oh, it's all spongy.
I like it when you do impressions of comedians.
Thank you. I met Eddie Izzard very briefly just the other day. He said, I know your hair.
And that was it.
Yes.
And then he moved
on. And then he talked about jam for a while.
So we should say hello to
Iddy Izzard.
Jason Isaacs and Stephen Fry and David Bowie and whoever else. Who else?
David Bowie, David Bowie, and indeed David Bowie.
And your friends, Fairport Convention, who you're going to be playing with very shortly.
Well, I'm playing at the Cropredy Festival, yes. We're doing some stuff up there. I think we should be broadcasting from up there.
Movies from Cropredy, very good. And also I can tell you, because I've seen his running order, that Bob Harris on Radio 2 on Saturday night from 11 o'clock will be playing some Dodge Brothers.
How do you know that?
Because I saw his running order, and I saw he had a Dodge Brothers CD, which he was raving about.
Oh, fantastic.
So there you go. I just want to mention this email just before it gets lost, because it's not pertaining to anything that we're discussing today, but it just is slightly intriguing. Come Steve on. In London. Dear Ardiles and Villa, a reference that you won't get.
Ozzy Ardiles and
Ricardo Villa.
No, say Aston Villa.
No. My mates and I had a drunken debate the other day about Disney films, and I tried to claim that Robin Hood, the one with the cartoon fox, is essentially a Ken Loach film. Please can Mark justify my drunken ramblings?
Well, in as much as, you know, he robs from the rich and gives to the poor, and there's not quite as much smoking, drinking and swearing as there is in most Ken Loach movies. I'd like to see you argue, in fact, that the Robin Hood film with, what's his name, Kevin Costner, is a Ken Loach film. There's a new Robin Hood film coming, isn't there? Isn't Ridley Scott doing one with the man who doesn't do a brilliant English accent?
Russell Crowe.
Oh, him. Yeah.
Yes, of course, the other version of Robin Hood, the version with Kevin Costner, is, of course, classically and much discussed, the one where he gets washed up on the
White Cliffs of Dover, then walks along, Sherwood Forest, gets there by evening.
No, he walks along Hadrian's Wall.
Oh, he does, that's right, he walks along Hadrian's Wall.
To get to Sherwood Forest.
Yeah, and he still gets there before nightfall.
So now, look, there's some interesting movies coming in. Lots of the correspondence basically is about Antichrist.
Great.
It's about Harry Potter.
Have people seen
Antichrist?
And
it's about Moon. Some people have seen it already. So we'll get to all those. Also, Charles Dickens' England appears to be out. Just Another Love Story and The Proposal. Sandra Bullock. I got a tweet a couple of weeks ago which just said, what are we going to do with Sandra Bullock? Which is quite an interesting.
No, that is.
An essay. We know that she's a good actress. We know that she's done some good films, but just not for a very long time.
No, it is true. It is hard. Being a Sandra Bullock fan is rather like being a Richard Gere fan. You get your heart broken so often. You go in there wanting the best, and then they so often let you down really badly. But you still somehow hang in there, just hoping that it'll be. I'll tell you, funnily enough, there is a film which owes a debt to While You Were Sleeping out this week, alongside the new Sandra Bullock movie. So it's a Danish thriller, a Danish film noir thriller, which owes a debt to a Sandra Bullock film, and you don't get many of them.
No, that's indeed very true. Lots of your correspondence, and try and get to as much as possible, but we have some movies to discuss as well. Do your box office top 10, first of all, at 10, Night at the Museum 2.
I mean, just astonishing that it's still in there.
Well, now some holidays people are going to go and kick in again. Maybe it's going to go back up the chart.
Well, you know, depressing because it's Night at the Museum 1 was joke over after that. As I've said 100 million times, Ricky Gervais is on the poster and in the film for about 10 seconds. I saw the trailer for the new Ricky Gervais Steve Merchant film in the cinema yesterday. I saw a preview of Nora Ephron film. And the trailer was Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant and Ralph Fiennes. And it owed a debt to that. I don't know whether you remember the trailer for Woody Allen's Annie Hall, which was Woody Allen just explaining the movie. He said, hey, I got a new movie coming in. You know, it's great and it's about really that, okay? But it's basically that. But Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant and Ralph Fiennes comes on.
So it's not a clip from the film?
No. It's literally just the two of them say, we've made this new film. We're very, very pleased about it. And then Ralph Fiennes comes on and then he says, yes, I'm in it. And they go, yeah, because you won an Oscar for Schindler's List. And he says, no, I didn't win. Oh, you didn't. Oh, and you're not very funny either. So it was like, anyway.
So you've done an Eddie Izzard impression. You've just done a Stephen Merchant.
Yes.
And Ricky Gervais. And Woody Allen. Three comedians in 5 minutes.
I can do Quentin Tarantino as well. Do you want me to do Quentin Tarantino? I mean, it's cool. It's cool. And just like, and I said, because it's there. And because it's there, I say, cool. Okay, so, okay.
Fine.
So he comes there, cool. And he says, like, okay, put it there. And he said, why is it there? Because it's there. Because it's cool. Okay? That's why it's there, because it's cool.
Stop now. I was in a shop and Quentin Tarantino turned up this week.
And he went, it's there. It's Simon, no, it's there because he's cool and he's there. And, you know.
I put it on Twitter. I said, I'm in a shop with Quentin Tarantino. What should I shout? Most people, essentially, it boiled down to why don't you make good
movies anymore?
But he has made a new movie.
Yeah, that we all had to sign an embargo not to talk about.
Why is that?
Oh, because it's nonsense.
What, the film is nonsense or because the whole embargo thing is nonsense?
The embargo is nonsense. I promise not to talk about this film before August the 14th.
Right, what's it like?
I couldn't possibly. It's like, it's cool, you know, because it's there and like that and it's like that. So that's what it's like.
If anyone can think of ways to tempt Mark to break this ridiculous embargo, mail@bbc.co.uk. So year one is at 9.
Yeah, which isn't funny, despite the fact that it has both Jack Black and Michael Cera, who I think are both funny people, and it's essentially a sub-Monty Python movie made by Americans who clearly don't understand Monty Python, which is a shame.
Now, it's Moon, and it's at number 8. Now, some correspondence here. Yes. Joe in Kentish Town. Dear Sam Bell and Sam Bell. Went to see Moon this week and thought it was excellent. Mark was bang on with his silent running Soylent Green comparisons.
Good.
Yes, much more, he says, than 2001 A Space Odyssey, which I didn't really feel was too similar. The only similarity being that the computer, ably voiced by Kevin Spacey, but without the chilling factor that Hal brought to that film. It was also refreshing to have this film clock in at under 100 minutes. You have so many films nowadays that feel the need to be in the 2 to 2.5 hour mark in order to be great films. This was a great film that didn't take up an entire evening. Paul... dear Dr. Parnassus and In Clover, given that I have to travel 20 miles to find a cinema showing Moon, I've no doubt it will evade your top 10. However, you're wrong, you see, because there it is at number 8.
And, you know, congratulations to Duncan Jones for it going in.
Of course. I just wanted to report that I loved this small sci-fi bit of wonderment, which harked right back to 70s classics like The Andromeda Strain.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, The Good Doctor's much prescribed Silent Running. What made the film all the more memorable was that, by chance, three seats to my left sat fine British actor Tim Roth. And
really?
three seats to my right sat fine British actor Kevin McNally. It was not a premiere, it wasn't a special screening, just a regular Monday afternoon showing at a central London cinema. I won't say which one, so that I can continue to enjoy a bit of celeb spotting as I watch my films. It's nice to know that when you go to the cinema, you might end up next to Mr. Orange or First Mate Joshamy Gibbs. Happy wittering. Anyway, so all very positive so far. Lee from Chippenham. Dear Severus and Tom, I had to travel many miles out of my way this week to see Moon in the single solitary cinema in the southwest in which it's showing. But boy, I'm glad I did. He says a career performance by Rockwell. So that'd be a career-defining
career-defining, career-best, career high point.
Engaging and interesting story and a haunting score left me feeling emotionally drained, but by the end, supremely happy. This is what cinema should be like. Here's hoping it'll soon get a much wider release so that I can go and see it again without a marathon trek across the country. One more, Tom in Windsor. Dear Trevor and Simon, I went last Sunday. You've got to be Trevor. I went to see Moon last Sunday. I hope it gets much more of a general release. Moon is the first film which I've watched at the cinema without having seen a trailer or heard a review beforehand. It is an incredible film, but having then seen trailers and reviews afterwards, I feel that they missed a trick by divulging too much of the storyline, something which we would never do on this programme. They should have maintained the mystery by only showing scenes from the first 20 minutes, and I would recommend that people see this movie whilst they only hear word of mouth. Does the good doctor agree?
Okay, it's a difficult thing, because in the case of Moon, because what happens isn't so much a revelation as just a development of the story, I don't agree that you shouldn't give that away, because I think the whole thing about it... I'm now trying very hard not to do it and see how hard I find it. It is very hard to talk about what that story is about if you don't essentially give the setup. It's not the punchline, it's the setup. I think in terms of explaining plots, you can explain the setup, but not the punchline, okay? But yes. I don't think the thing is set up. But now that the gentleman has said that we shouldn't even say that, all he can say is, it's Sam Rockwell on the moon with Kevin Spacey's voice.
Yes.
Go see. But it's a really good film. I'm really glad that people are sort of clicking into that, you know, the dystopian sci-fi thing from the early 70s. That is when it is. I mean, because the very interesting thing about Duncan Jones is that he was the wrong age to have really watched those movies the first time around. He's the Blade Runner generation. I mean, he's the person that would have been the first big sci-fi film that he saw. He did all the films that he's invoking, whether it's Solaris or Soylent Green or Andromeda Strain or Silent Running or any of those films. They are all, you know, early 70s, that late 60s sort of dystopian fantasy movie. And I loved Moon. I was just, I thought partly, maybe it's because I'm a 46-year-old bloke, but it's terrific to hear that everybody else likes it as much, and I hope everybody goes and sees it in the cinema. It's a really good, intelligent science fiction movie that is about ideas. It's not about robots hitting each other, it's about ideas.
And an awful lot of people just frustrated about how far they have to travel to go and see it. So yeah. Bearing all that in mind, the fact that it's in at number 8 is
very impressive,
good,
very good.
And in Leeds, I'll buy Mark a beer at 5 tonight. No, make it 5:30 if he breaks the embargo. And then continues strangely. Embargo is a lovely word, like the special beer at the Fox in Leeds. It's a long way to come for a beer. I'll drink it for him. Keep the embargo. So, now, just on Moon, Simon in Exeter. All right, Mortimer and Randolph Duke, saw Moon last night, and without doubt, it's my second best film of the year after Gran Torino. Although watching the effects can sometimes make you feel you're watching a serious Gerry Anderson show, everything else about it was superb. Sam Rockwell is brilliant and playing two roles, and the interactions between the two are sublime. The plot seems twisty, but makes total sense halfway through. Also, Clint Mansell's score is another classic and moves you heartbreaking at times when Sam finds out the truth. Fabulous, absolutely fabulous. So,
and unfortunately, he just gave away the plot, because it's impossible not to by saying Sam Rockwell.
Well, he just discovers the truth.
No, not that. Sam Rockwell plays two roles. It's like the thing about the credits for The Crying Game, which give away the thing. It was the thing that gave away the plot of Crying Game was when Jay, what's his name, got nominated for Best Supporting Actor rather than Best Supporting Actress, after which there was no longer any twist.
Paul on this, Dear Winged Eel Fingerling and Zoot Horn Rollo.
That's lost me.
I have an original cinema poster of The Exorcist signed by Peter Blatty.
William Peter
and
Blatty.
William Friedkin here on my desk. Unless the quiffed one, bracket Zoot Horn Rollo, speaks up about Tarantino's latest piece of rubbish, it's going into the office shredder. Spill your guts, Kermode.
It's long.
Maybe that's
so long.
That's the poster gets it, I think. Okay, so we'll continue to try and tempt that, but it might be a while. Ice Age, Dawn of the Dinosaurs, number 7.
That'll
do. My Sister's Keepers at 6.
Yeah, stick to the ditzy comedies.
Public Enemies at 5.
See, this is interesting because an awful lot of people now have been to see Public Enemies and have had the same reservations that I had, which was that if you're a Michael Mann fan, it doesn't feel like the great leap forward that a big, new, successful Michael Mann film should be. On the other hand, the fact that it's in the top 10 and it's holding its own is deeply encouraging, because Michael Mann is a proper filmmaker and a proper director, and I think Johnny Depp is good in the film. I think there are many flaws with it. I think Marianne Cotillard is too strong to be used only so sparsely, and I think that it isn't anything that we haven't seen before with Michael Mann. I'm also troubled by the camera work, which seems to me to be at a disjoint to the material. But it is still a Michael Mann film, and of course you should go and see it.
We have Transformers Revenge of the Fallen at number 4.
Is there anything else to say about Transformers Revenge of the Fallen?
Well, it turns out, there is. Colm Walsh in Kildare. Dear Doctor in Trouble and Doctor in the Clover. Just listened to a review of Transformers, Revenge of the Swollen, and I think there was more to complain about. You let them off lightly.
Yeah.
Two of the new robots are codified black, and they use Afro-American street language laughs.
They do.
A la old-fashioned Uncle Tom humour of the minstrels genre. At one point, one robot says, "We's don't do reading." Yes. Which is a disgraceful racist muck. This is not to mention the dog porn, the robot porn, and, of course, the elder drug abuse. If this is the biggest financial investment in entertainment this year, is it any wonder the state of capitalism? Discuss.
Yeah, no, well, I just absolutely just pin that to a wall and add it to all previous comments. You're quite right. Quite right. I'm not going to argue with it at all.
His email is headlined, Transformers, Racists in Disguise. I didn't stay for that long, I don't think.
No, you didn't get as far as... No, I think the two robots had turned up by the point that you left, but John Turturro hadn't said. But you were there for an hour and a half.
Yeah, I don't think it was that, actually. It was more like 40 minutes.
No. It was quite a long... Well, I mean, it just seemed like it went on forever and ever and ever.
And there's loads more stuff, I think. After finding my choice of film vetoed this week by a friend who simply gave a reason of, I don't know who Eric Cantona is, I found myself sitting in a cinema watching Transformers 2.
No! So you could have gone to see Looking for Eric and you went to see Transformers 2 because your friend didn't know Eric Cantona was.
This is Joe Clift who's writing this.
Oh, Joe, honestly, truly, change your friends.
A truly awful film with the ridiculous ancient writing storyline and the resultant hunt around the pyramids. It seemed like a nightmarish mix of Power Rangers and National Treasure. I well and truly apologise for contributing to Keep It Up the UK Top 10, if indeed it survived there another week.
Too right. And the other thing that a number of people have pointed out is it's all very well bashing Michael Bay, which is all very well. And incidentally, I'd encourage everybody to carry on doing it. Maybe we can actually talk him out of cinema. But some of the can for this has to be carried by Steven Spielberg, whose name is associated with the movie and really, really should be ashamed of himself, because he knows what proper films are meant to look like, you know, and he's a smart guy.
The Hangover's at 3.
She's nothing like as funny as it ought to be, and it is basically Dude, Where's My Car in Las Vegas.
Bruno is at number 2.
But in which version?
Well, it doesn't say, actually.
Yeah, you see, now I'm...
Is that 18 plus 15
equals 2? I don't know. And there's an interesting question here about whether or not they're totting the two things up or whether they're counting the movies as separate. What they've done, as you probably know, is that they've cut... It's something like 90 seconds out of Bruno in order to get it a 15 certificate audience so that, you know, younger viewers can go and see it. And raises many questions. I mean, firstly, the alleged purity of Sacha Baron Cohen's comic intentions are clearly undermined by the fact that you can cut bits out of it, in the same way that I think the sort of intentions that Mel Gibson had, oh yes, there's only one way the Passion of the Christ can be done, there's only one way the Passion of the Christ can be done, there's only one way, but what, I can make more money out of doing it differently? Sorry, there are only two, I'll come in again. It's like the Spanish Inquisition, you know, nobody expects the recut version of Bruno.
You don't have to do Python having already done Eddie Izzard, Ricky Gervais and Woody Allen.
Which one was your favourite?
I had no
Woody Allen, I think
I had no favourites.
And Woody Allen could so easily go over into Quentin Tarantino, couldn't he?
No favourites. Okay. Carry on.
Yeah, no, so I'm interested to know whether they're totting the two things up together. And, I mean, it's funny because it is only a 90-second distinction, but I just think the idea of rejigging the film in order to get more money in is somehow out of whack with the apparent serious purpose of the comedy, which is, as we were told by the film company, exposing the following list of things that are bad.
UK's number one, no surprise, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Lots of correspondence about that. We should do some up to three, do some the other side of three, and some new reviews coming up. Paul and Emma.
Yes.
Just come out of the Harry Potter film, and apart from the 11 10-year-old sat behind trumping throughout the film, I would like to give the film 5 out of 5.
Very good.
Very dark, akin to the recent Batman films. Excellent acting by all, especially Alan Rickman and Helena BC, and fast-paced. Unlike the books, but I think that you have to separate the films from the book. My only criticism, no Jason Isaacs. Hopefully that will be addressed in the next instalment.
It will be addressed in the next instalment. Yes, it does. Yeah, yeah, of course. Because, in fact, there is a very, very, very crucial role.
Indeed.
I mean, you know.
Pretty crucial.
Yeah, I mean, we can't give it away, although people have read the books, which have been on the shelves for the last 4 years.
But apparently,
we go, Jason Isaacs is definitely coming back, and hooray, hooray, and hooray.
Jen Chapman, BA Oxon First Class.
First
class. Not outstanding, but exceeded expectations.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Patrick on this. Patrick McKenzie.
I thought it was outstanding in many places.
10 GCSEs, one module of AS level maths pending August 27th. As far as I'm concerned, this was the best Harry Potter. Overall, it had so much charm. And there are a few good jumps as well. As someone who got a love of reading from Harry Potter, I am ridiculously pedantic about all the little details. But on the whole, it was very true to the book. My only issues were that the attack on the Weasley's house, which you mentioned last week, which I found completely unnecessary, and the time used for that could have been used on the fight after the unfortunate event.
Yes, I would agree with that. You don't understand the attack on the Weasley's house either, do
well,
you?
There's lots more on this coming up. Another issue was with Fenrir Greyback, the half-werewolf. He is such a frightening character in the book, and thought the film would have been vastly improved if he was developed and we knew more about him. And
I think you will do, won't you?
Right, maybe. And Snape, before the unfortunate event, seems to suggest he is good to Harry by telling him to be quiet. So I didn't think that was ambiguous enough. But overall, I thought it was very good, and Jim Broadbent was brilliant, and Rupert Grint is by far the most improved child actor. However, I still find Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson to be complete drips and don't accurately portray their respective characters. This from Alex in his truck in a lay-by. Simon, Wingdeal Fingerling and Zoot Horn Rollo, referred to the other
jazz musicians?
Guitarist in Captain Beefheart's Magic Band on the spotlight.
Oh, that's shameful. I didn't know that. That's absolutely shameful.
Rock on, says Alex.
Yeah, no, actually, I should give up now. That is really shameful, and I am genuinely
call
ashamed.
Yourself a cultural icon.
No, I don't. I'm clearly not. No, the not knowing that is appalling.
Here's today's big question, though. From James, dear Samantha and Mrs. Trellis, if you can cut 90 seconds out of Bruno to make it a 15, how many seconds would you need to cut out of Antichrist to make it a PG?
Actually,
a lot. The whole feel of the first 10 minutes that I watched is inappropriate.
Okay, it contains moderate threat.
And we're trying to get Mark to break the embargo on the Quentin Tarantino movie, Theo in Hull. Dear Big Cook and Little Cook, if Mark breaks the embargo, I'll bin my wife's U2 CDs.
See, that's so tempting. So tempting.
So, some reviews from Harry Potter, specifically about the unhappy event. I think everyone knows what we're talking about, but it will remain as the unhappy event, which features towards the end of this particular film. The Reverend Alison Waters, M.A. Oxon, P.G. Dip in Pastoral Theology, Basic Food Hygiene Certificate Part 1 in Shepparton. Dear Fred and George, after persuading my new husband that it was part of his nuptial duties to accompany me to every new Harry Potter film, I have to concur with the good doctor that this is the second best film in the series after Prisoner.
Excellent.
I have to disagree with you both, however, regarding the unhappy event. Okay. Seeing the film after listening to your review, I expected to find the rendering of this tragic moment unsatisfactory, but in fact, I found it moving and enlightening.
Good.
Now, I've edited a lot of this, hopefully it'll still be fine.
Okay.
In The Half-Blood Prince, Harry is on the verge of adulthood. He witnesses the universal horror of the rise of Voldemort, yet he is still a relatively cosseted schoolboy at Hogwarts. In the scene in question, the Dark Mark is not yet in the skies. Harry doesn't realise that the Death Eaters have entered the school, so that is he is under no imperative to act. His shocking use of the Septum Semper spell against Malfoy early in the film would likely have stayed his hand. That Harry should be paralysed by disbelief, uncertainty and the commands of two teachers, rather than by a spell, which is what we're discussing, adds great power to the scene and mirrors the limits of his 17-year-old self.
I think it's a very interesting point. Did you say that was from a...
The Reverend Alison Waters, M.A. Oxon.
Well, I think it's very interesting because that has come from a theologian. And funnily enough, the other person I know who said a very similar thing is a priest. And so it may well be that if you are of a mind to find such things, the meaning is in that scene.
Yes,
I mean, when we say it's disappointing, it's not that you go, oh, that's nothing. It's not that it's nothing. It's just that it's such a curveball in that the way that it's done. I mean, I understand what's being said. I think that letter was argued beautifully, incidentally, and I will go back and see it again because I will happily sit through the film again because it is clearly the second best after Azkaban.
If you're wondering what this is about, the whole point about the unhappy event is we were saying last week that in the book, the unhappy event happens because Harry's put under a spell so he can't do anything about it. In the book, it's just that he's told not to do anything about it.
No, in the film. Crucially,
and then wonders why.
In the book, he cannot act. In the film, he does not act. And that, particularly from a theological point of view, incidentally, is very, very significant because it's to do with free will.
I hadn't thought of that. Tony Martin, BA Honours PGCE.
Keep up.
Dear Jekyll and Hyde, only one's a proper doctor. As an avid listener to the Film Reviews podcast, I've barely ever found myself in disagreement with the good doctor. However, recently watched Harry Potter 6, thought it was a complete all-at sequel. I, too, have found Azkaban to be by far and away the most coherent and enjoyable of the films. This offering, however, was a strangely listless effort. The first half packed too much with toe-curling slapstick jokes about girls. The third quarter spent attempting to build some tension in anticipation of a final good versus evil battle. When the end credits started rolling and the lights came up, I involuntarily blurted out, "Is that it?" As having not read the book, I'd been expecting the film to continue its march towards a big final showdown, which apparently...
That is the big final showdown.
...had already taken place. This peculiar melange of slapstick humour and darker, more fascinating plot development took the edge off what could have been a very good film. Add to this a dire final half hour and a very, very unhappy portrayal of the unhappy event, and I was left wondering what had happened in the last couple of hours.
I think it's really interesting that the film that has thrown up so much debate about that. I mean, I think in a way that almost validates it. That almost validates the decision. Was that because people can have such different perspectives and that almost validates the decision. I mean, it wasn't the decision for me, but I want to go back and see it again and see whether... And I also suspect that there may be something coming up in the next two that explains that decision better.
And Rowan in Bradford on the Horcruxes idea, which we were talking about last week as
it
well.
It must be Horcruxe, mustn't it? It can't be one Horcrux, no. Two Horcruxes.
It's Horcruxes. It's not a Horcruxe.
Ought to be.
Rowan in Bradford, following your recent conversation about the concept of Horcruxes in the latest Harry Potter film, it occurred to me that this idea has been used to some effect in another older yet somehow similar book
Lord
and film
Rings.
Franchise. Isn't Sauron's ring in Lord of the Rings the original Horcrux? Sauron makes himself immortal by pouring part of himself into the ring, thus giving the ring its deadly power. Being generous, surely the Horcrux is an admiring reference to Tolkien, or am I merely imagining it?
I think the fact that there are precursors doesn't mean that it's not an original idea. It's like that Stephen Fry quote, isn't it? An original idea? Well, there must be thousands of them in the library. Just because it has precedent doesn't mean that it's not still it doesn't still have originality. But clearly, yes, it's not the first person ever to have come up with the idea of putting a part of yourself into an object. In fact, you could find that in Hellraiser, in the Clive Barker movie. I mean, the whole thing with the cube is essentially a Horcrux.
Let me see if I can just do one more on the unhappy event and without, again, spoiling it for everybody, which I did a couple of
weeks
ago.
Yes, you did. Well done.
Dear Draco and Fenrir, I was watching the unhappy event. I was struck by the moment... Oh, I can't do that. This is talking about Snape and Harry. Their hostile eyes meet and Snape cautions Harry to be quiet.
Yes.
Seeming to be complicit in purpose. Then, for the first time, Harry finally decides to trust Snape. And let him intercede in the unfolding drama.
But is that what happens?
Hang on, Ellie says, I thought this was a huge moment. It made Snape's next action an even deeper betrayal, and I imagine its implications will run very deep, both in Harry's self-hatred for not, as Simon said, taking his normal role as saving hero, and his hatred for Snape will be even more intense.
Can I say that I think that the shush is ambiguous? I think that when Snape puts his fingers up and he's holding his wand, that you can read it one of two ways. You can either read it that he says shush and Harry shushes because he trusts Snape, or that Snape, in the same way as a man with a gun in one hand, and says shh.
You know who?
No, thank you.
That would have worked.
That is threatening. I mean, I actually read Snape's gesture at that point as threatening.
Well, the debate will continue.
It will.
85058, mayo@bbc.co.uk.
Antichrist.
Well, do you want to do that? Do you want to start? Let's start it.
No, no, because can I start? I'd rather do something else and then come back to
you. You want to peek too early?
No, because I want to have a good... So let me very quickly mention to you Charles Dickens' England. Now, you know that I had complained about The Queen not being a real film.
Well, you say it was sort of more for television.
Yeah, I said it's not a real film.
Yeah, because it was made for television.
It's made for television, yeah. And that was why, when I was at the BAFTAs, Dame Helen Mirren came and tapped me on the shoulder and went, "Oi, what do you mean it's not a real film?" At which point I went, "What's Helen Mirren?" And I prevented myself from launching into a staunch defence of Tinto Brass's original cut of Caligula at that point. But Helen said, the problem was, it's a television movie.
She'd have thought you were a pretentious oaf if you'd done
I'm sure
that.
She thinks I'm a pretentious oaf anyway, which is perfectly fine with me. So anyway, Charles Dickens, England. If... On a scale of 1 to 10, okay, 10 is a film, right? And one is a television programme. Say, for example, Look Northwest. I mean, demonstrably a television programme as opposed to a film.
A local television programme.
Yeah, so a television programme.
Is that the lowest of the low? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying it's bad.
I'm just cheap.
No, hang on. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying it is a television programme as opposed to a film. So on the one hand, you have 2001 A Space Odyssey, film, right? Widescreen looks rubbish on television. On the other hand, you have Look Northwest, a television programme.
See, I think Look East is probably a bit cheaper.
Fine. In order to stop the bickering, I'll go for Look East, okay? So one, Look East, 10, 2001. I would say The Queen, about 3, right? Charles Dickens' England, minus 50.
Oh, my word.
I sat in a cinema for 2 hours... 2 hours.
How long?
2 hours watching Derek Jacobi in a television programme that incidentally will be playing on Sky Arts in 2 48-minute episodes, wandering around London and other places going, here is a house that Charles Dickens once lived in. Who knows what he may have wrote here? And then walking off a little bit, they're going, here is another house that Charles Dickens lived in. Here, he may have written something else. And then he gets into a car, and then he gets out of the car, and he goes, and here is another house.
At one point,
right, he does this brilliant moment. It's literally Derek Jacobi takes you on a televisual tour of places that Charles Dickens might have once sat down. It's like, you know, the houses program, you know, property, but with Charles Dickens, as presented by the most incompetent presenter in the form of Derek Jacobi, fine Shakespearean actor, clearly unable to deliver to camera a line. And here is another place where Charles Dickens, two fantastic moments. One of them in which he's telling us all about the inspiration for Charles Dickens and where he got his characters from. He says, one thing we know about Charles Dickens is that many of his characters were inspired by names from graves. Here, for example, is a grave upon which is the name Dorrit, spelt D-O, you know, blah, 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 blah.
He goes, I get the message.
Hang on.
John Pienaar's going to just talk about David Cameron. We'll come back to you. Sorry to interrupt you in full flow.
I need to put two things very quickly.
This is Charles Dickens'
England. Just going to finish this. Dickens is England, incidentally. Dickens, apostrophe S. I thought you just do Dickens with an apostrophe after it, but Dickens is England. Two things. One of them is a fantastic moment when he shows us a gravestone and says, on this gravestone is the name Dorrit. It's not spelt the same, but it sounds the same. Yeah. That's therefore not the same name. And another moment which baffled me entirely, in which he's standing in the street in Chinatown in the West End, you know Chinatown in the West End, in London's busy West End.
And he says, bustling
Chinatown behind him, many people who live in Chinatown, and he gestures to a building behind him and says, Dickens had lodgings here. And then he looks around at the new incumbent and says, I can't think what he would have made of it now. What does that even mean? And this goes on for 2 hours. 2 hours of... he goes into restaurants and orders a dry white wine. And so we know he drinks dry white wine. At one point, we see that he's run up a taxi bill of £41.82. Why? Is there a tax return issue here? What's going on? I would say that it was a bad film, except it's not a film. I didn't go into film criticism to watch television programmes. I didn't.
It's the kind of thing you get as a free DVD with the Sunday Express.
It's the sort of thing that you get on an aeroplane on the way from America to England. Hey, what are we going to watch on the way to England? Let's watch Charles Dickens in England. Derek Jacobi telling us about Charles Dickens and his England and Plymouth Hoe. And, it's not a film. It's not a film, and please don't waste 2 hours of my life making me watch a television programme.
Stan and Ollie, Mark needs to spill the beans. This is about the Tarantino film. So you can honestly say that he is not on the Hollywood payroll. Or allowing a distributor to tie his tongue is a serious betrayal of his ethics and his honour. Anyway, a certain magazine, as in Spielberg's Of the Sun, has given a full write-up on it.
No, it's been reviewed everywhere. I mean, it's been reviewed all over the place. It was reviewed when it was in Cannes. I mean, it's total nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. What can you say? It's just a stupid thing.
Chris at Camp Bestival, dear Fiat and 238, talk about Tarantino's movie and I will finance a ComSat Angels world tour.
Okay, so the thing about it is it's way too long and it doesn't make any sense. And the minute that Eli Roth walks in, you give up. Anyway.
It's being prized out.
Can I very quickly, because we've got 3 minutes for the news, I want to get in one other thing before we get to Antichrist, okay?
Neil Sawyer in Birmingham.
And that's not what I wanted to get in.
Dear Holmes and Yo-Yo, if Mark can't review the Tarantino flick himself, could he let us know how Woody Allen might do so?
Can I very quickly tell you about this? This just another love story thing, because I'm aware that time will rush away with us. Okay, there are two Danish films out this week. One of them is, you can leap into something else.
Would I?
Can I just do this quickly, okay? There's a Danish film called Just Another Love Story by Ole Bornedal, of course, whose name will be very familiar to you because he's the guy who made Night Watch twice, okay? He made a European version, then he remade it in the English language with Ewan McGregor, and the remake wasn't very good at all. But he was an interesting director, and I thought he had something, and then he kind of disappeared and, you know, went off and did other stuff for a while. Anyway, he's now back with this thing called Just Another Love Story, which is this sort of Danish neo-noir thriller, which, oddly enough, begins and ends like Sunset Boulevard, with somebody apparently narrating from beyond the grave or on their deathbed, and owes a very strange debt to that Sandra Bullock film, While You Were Sleeping. Remember in While You Were Sleeping, the guy falls on the railway track, she saves him, and he's then in hospital, and she goes to his bedside, and the family imagine that she knows him, but she doesn't know him at all. And by the time he finally wakes up, everyone's imagined that, in fact, she's his fiancée.
Give it away.
No, that's the beginning. That's the setup. That's not the payoff. So then she has to spend the rest of the movie him thinking he has amnesia and he has forgotten her, which he hasn't, because he didn't know her in the first place. Well, so now, Just Another Love Story, which is essentially that Sandra Bullock movie as remade by a dark, moody Danish person. And I thought it was a very, very interesting thriller. Story is, a family man has stayed, sort of fed up with his life. He's in a cronky old car that breaks down, therefore causes a car crash because somebody runs into the back of him. And in the car that crashes is this sort of strange, tearaway, oddly attractive to him young woman, who is, in fact, on the run from a lover who, at the beginning of the film, we think she's killed, but we're not quite sure. And he then goes to visit her in hospital to see if she's all right, and is mistaken for the boyfriend from whom she was running away. And he then sees, in this possible misapprehension, a whole other life kind of opening up to him. It's kind of like, remember that John Landis movie, Into the Night?
Ooh,
which had David, funny enough, had David Bowie, Barry Barry in it, very briefly. Had Jeff Goldblum and Michelle Pfeiffer. It's a story about somebody who can't sleep, and he goes to an airport car park, and suddenly Michelle Pfeiffer lands on his car, and he goes off into this whole other world. Well,
oh, that one.
Yes. Just Another Love Story is essentially a riff on that, saying what happens if your life took a left turn, if you suddenly became someone else and people believe you are this other person. And although the story is contrived, and although, in the words of the director, he says this in the director's statement, he says, "I've attempted to create an unrestrained piece of modern drama which, while seriously derailing, is still recognisable to us in the inner chamber of our souls," which sounds terribly pretentious. And yet, watching the film itself, I didn't think it was pretentious at all. I thought it was a really good, intriguing psychological thriller. Yes, outlandish in its plot developments, and there are certain things that clearly, if you're in a realist sort of mode, I think you could dig big holes in. But as a good psychological thriller, which was very, very sort of atmospherically shot and had very restrained performances by the cast, which made the outlandishness of the plot twist seem all the more credible, I found it a very engaging piece. And it rekindled for me the belief that Ole Bornedal does actually have something to offer, and I was very pleased to see it. So if you get a chance, do go and see it. Lars von Trier isn't the only Danish maverick in town.
Anna Lohmann.
Yeah.
Says, what if you don't know what the unhappy event is, but would like to? This is Harry Potter 6. Buy the book, read, and so, you know, it's
I
in
believe
the last
it
third.
Is available in popular bookshops.
Dominic, Dominic in Rugeley. The unhappy event for me is that Terry Gilliam isn't spearheading this series of films. Roll on the Imaginarium. Doug, with no qualifications. Yeah. Can Mark whisper the Tarantino plot to Simon, who, not being a world famous
I'm not going to because I don't. You know, when I tell a film, when somebody says, "Oh, you can't review this film," fine, I don't care. Can't really be bothered.
This says, "Dear Tony and Ridley, I went to my third ever press screening yesterday is it Inglorious Bastards? Is that
yeah?
What
that's how it's but misspelt.
Busted.
No,
Inglorious Bastards.
Bastards.
I realise
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And happened to sit just a few small feet away from the good doctor. He may have noticed me gazing with wonder at his quiff. Anyway, I'm eagerly awaiting the day, many moons in the future, when he'll be allowed to vent his opinion. In the meantime, I prepared a special pre-embargo review. I'm completely serious, and post-embargo, this will be my one-line summary. Here it is. Surprisingly, it's the blankiest film I've seen since blank, 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 blank. I encourage conjecture. Is an interesting one. Anne in Warwick. Dear Peters and Lee.
Mm-hmm. I'll
be the singer.
Welcome. What do you mean you'll be the singer? They're both singers.
I'm hiding upstairs, giving my teenage daughter some space while she watches Shawshank Redemption for the first time.
Ah.
She's accompanied by far more good-looking young teenage boys than I think necessary. Anyway, so you think she's watching it?
Read her excerpts from my BFI Modern Classic about it. That'll knock any sense of fun out of them.
Anyway, my question is whether I should disturb her and stop the film before the final scene, giving her the opportunity to see the film as it should be.
Yes.
What does Dr. K think?
Yes, exactly. Well done. When he gets on the bus, I hope, and then rush in there and press the end button and go, that's the end of the film.
Because that will go down really well and impress all those boys.
You don't want all the nonsense at the Huataneo. Nobody needs that.
By the way, Anne says, did anyone else notice that Mock the Week unashamedly gave away the detail of the unfortunate event last night with no apology? I suppose they think they're allowed to, under the veil of satire.
Yes.
It's 3:37. You might have heard of Antichrist. You might have heard our interview with the very nice Willem Dafoe when he came in a couple of weeks ago. It's the Lars von Trier film.
Yes.
And this is what Mark thinks.
Well, okay, so in case you're not up to speed with this, there's been an awful lot of publicity about it. And I have to say at the beginning, congratulations to the publicity team who have managed to make essentially a Danish art house movie about theology into the big talked about selling point of the week. One of the things that's happened is that the von Trier movie, Antichrist, played in Cannes. When it played in Cannes, there was, as you quite rightly say, there was some booing, there was some, you know, outrage, blah-de-blah-de-blah, but actually not a massive amount. Since then, the fires of this have been stoked up by some articles in the press. One which is sort of leading the pack, which is an article in the Daily Mail, which is just superbly daft to the point that I wondered whether or not it was a put-up job. It begins, it's by Christopher Hart. It begins, he's describing the thing as, one critic who prides himself on being broad-minded says, and I quote, "I haven't seen it myself, nor shall I, and I speak as a broad-minded arts critic, but merely reading about Antichrist is stomach-turning enough to form a judgment," which he then goes on to say, "it contains horrors the likes of which I have never witnessed." No, you haven't seen it, that's why. It doesn't shock or surprise me in the slightest that Europe now produces such pieces of sick, pretentious trash, fully confirming our jihadist enemies' view of us as a society in the last stage of corruption and decay, although I haven't seen it. And it goes on like this at some length. It's funny because I think that, of course, Lars von Trier would be very happy about that piece, and which is kind of the reason why I almost thought it was a satire. Because when people write articles that begin, "I haven't seen this, but I'm sure it's absolutely disgraceful," I do automatically imagine that they're joking. Whether joking or not, it doesn't matter, because clearly what von Trier wants of the response is, you know, one way or the other, and all of it adds to the momentum behind the film, which is in the end an art house movie. So on behalf of the people publicising the film, congratulations to the Daily Mail for doing a very good job of publicising it, because that's exactly what the makers of it would have wanted. As I said, I'm not quite sure of the tone of that piece. I'm not quite sure whether it's serious or a joke, but I think it's serious. But in which case, it's, you know, as I said, it's done nothing but help the film. So what you have is a Lars von Trier movie with essentially two people in it, Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg, playing a man and a woman. At the beginning of the film, they are seen in an embrace, in a black and white sequence, and whilst they are in this embrace, their child falls from the window of their house. The film then moves on to a sequence in which they are grieving. He is a therapist. She is a non-specific academic who seems to be doing a thesis in genocide, which is like, you know, misogyny turned into genocide. It was a very sort of 1970s thesis, the kind of thing that people would write about, you know, a long time ago. It's strangely anachronistic. And you know that when Willem Dafoe was here, he said, "Well, actually, I don't think that's to be taken very seriously. I think that was just a shorthand as a way of saying that she's a progressive feminist." Well, yeah, I think there's more to it than that. You'll also remember that Willem Dafoe said he didn't think, as I did, that it's a film about misogyny. It's clearly a film about misogyny. It doesn't matter what Willem says. It doesn't make any difference. Trust the tale, not the teller. It doesn't matter whether you're in a film, doesn't mean you understand it. I mean, it really doesn't. I do understand the film more than he does, because I've seen it. He was just in it. It's a totally different thing. So it is clearly a film about misogyny. Good. Anyway, he, being a therapist, takes her on as his patient, and he decides that what they need to do is to return to Eden, a wood cabin in this non-specific area, which is obviously called Eden, therefore clearly biblical, where she spent some time with the child before the child died. And during the course of their time in Eden, she comes to believe that everything in the world is evil, including, to some extent, womankind. Here's a clip.
Acorns don't cry. You know that as well as I do. That's what fear is. Your thoughts distort reality. Not the other way around.
Satan's church.
Satan.
Nature is Satan's church.
What?
Why, there you have him. That was his brother.
So here's what you need to know. Firstly, Antichrist contains some of von Trier's best work. There are visual images in it that are very, very striking. It obviously owes an awful lot to generic movies. I mean, it does owe a debt to horror movies, clearly to the tradition of, for example, the, you know, the Cabin in the Woods movies like Evil Dead, clearly to some extent to the modern so-called torture porn movement, clearly to some extent to Exorcist, from which it takes some subliminals and also some soundtrack stuff. And it's playing with horror genre conventions. And I have to say, doing it rather well. I mean, there are moments in which essentially what he tries to do is to create an uncanny, eerie atmosphere, and he does it pretty solidly. And I think for an awful lot of credit for that must go to Anthony Dobmantle, who's the cinematographer, who of course shot Slumdog Millionaire, and is frankly a genius and is really, really great. It's interesting, of course, that von Trier started off by coming up with the dogma principles that he came up with Thomas Vinterberg, all these things that you couldn't do. You know, you must have handheld cameras, you mustn't have artifice, the director mustn't be credited, you mustn't have special effects, you mustn't have artificial sound effects. And this is his most artifice laden movie. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing is the performances are great. Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg really go for it. They turn everything up to 11, and you do get a sense in their company of a real sense of conviction and sincerity from the performers. Now, I think it is important to distinguish the sincerity of the performances from the sincerity of the direction and the idea, because no matter how much everyone says Lars meant this film, Lars was depressed when he made this film, I never believe anything that anyone says about Lars von Trier, least of all what Lars von Trier says about himself. Lars can tell you that he's depressed, fine. He says all those, he just says things because he's a prankster. You must never believe anything he says at all. The film he made before this was a film called The Boss of It All, which was a comedy in inverted commas that wasn't funny, that began by saying this film doesn't mean anything, it's completely without meaning, it's totally empty, which is kind of a way of saying actually there is a meaning here, but it's a double bluff, there isn't a meaning. I'm going to stop because you held your hand up.
Yes, absolutely. Is there part two to come?
There is. Oh, there's okay. Part three and four.
All right, some more of this in just a moment. I've got some Antichrist correspondence, but I have a feeling you're not... Pardon?
Yeah, I'm not finished yet.
Yeah, well, I realise that. Okay. So do you want to...
I want to finish first. I need another 4 minutes.
Oh, my word.
Sorry. No, it's important. I haven't got to the... Okay, because look, this is a long time coming, so let me do this and then I'll be quiet, okay?
Okay, and you should... The film that you've described so far is sort of unrecognisable... The way it's been reported in terms of the
it's not
bad
because,
stuff. That
no,
goes
I
on.
Think because I say if you are part of the people of the body of people who say it's outrageous, it's shocking, it should be banned, it's disgusting, then you are part of the machine. You are part of the response that the film wants to provoke. Okay, it's simple as that.
There's
not
a big difference between
you
saying
one.
It's shocking, it's outrageous.
Yeah,
the people will think that, but they might not just do the other thing and say it should be banned.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that what von Trier wants is people to say it should be banned, and then other people to say no, it's a very, very serious work, and it's neither of those things, because as I said, with von Trier you can't trust anything he says. All you can trust is the film itself. So funnily enough, tonally, the film that it reminded me of most, and I'm surprised that this hasn't come up elsewhere, is the Andrzej Żuławski film Possession.
I was just going to mention
that. You were going to mention that. Which starred Isabelle Adjani and has a similar sort of shrieking, hysterical, psychosexual tone to it. And for which, coincidentally, Adjani, unless I'm mistaken, won the Best Actress Award at Cannes, which, of course, Gainsbourg did. And there is a very strange tonal similarity in that both films are demented, and both films achieve a kind of level of hysterical madness and lunacy which is generated around a female character and relation to her sexuality in relation to demonic imagery and possession and darkness. And I think they are very, very closely related films, and I'm a big fan of Possession. And incidentally, much as I think there are great things to be said about Antichrist, I don't think it's as good as Possession, but it took most people quite a long time to get their heads around Possession. And remember, Possession was included on the original list of video nasties, the films which were deemed undistributable originally by the Director of Public Prosecutions under the terms of the Obscene Publications Act. So there is a connection there as well. I think the important thing to say is that the elements that are in Antichrist that are shocking are both shocking and at the same time satirical. You shouldn't believe that when things happen in horror movies, they are to be taken literally. They are to be taken metaphorically. And of course, one of the things that von Trier does and has done throughout his career is to take an idea and run with it, no matter how outrageous. Now, the worst of those, I think, is Breaking the Waves, which I think is a genuinely pernicious and misogynist movie, which absolutely deifies the idea of the child woman being abused and therefore receiving her reward in heaven. And it's, I think that's a deeply messed up film. And I do incidentally think that Lars von Trier's relationship to women is at very best suspect. You look at films like Mandalay or Dogville, in which he takes that idea of slaves enslaving themselves. Again, he takes the idea and he takes it to its logical conclusion. The Idiots, I thought, another film in which he took that the idea about people pretending to be disabled, and it completely backfired, and he tried to spice it up with some, you know, hardcore scenes which were totally gratuitous and didn't need to be there at all. And of course, I shouted at the screen in Cannes. I don't think anybody should have banned the film, which of course they didn't. I just thought it was a load of old nonsense. I didn't think it was obscene. I just thought it was total nonsense. So he's playful, he's a prankster. He said of his last film that it was shot with a thing called Automovision. This was the boss of it all. Automovision, which was a computer technique, for a principle for shooting film developed with the intention of limiting human influence by inviting chance in from the cold. I read serious reviews of that film that took that. I mean, he's making it up, okay? He doesn't mean it. That doesn't mean that you can't look at the film itself and take the film as seriously as you want to take it. And as a tonal piece, as a piece about grief, as a piece about shrieking sexual hysteria, which is also about misogyny, because it is clear that the narrative line of Antichrist is misogynist, but it's so misogynist that actually it's kind of out the other end and becomes a commentary on misogyny, because it is a film in which one of the characters kind of decides that all evil in the world probably does come from women. And as I say, it's a sarcastic film. The tone of it is largely sarcastic and ironic, and in a way, my problem with von Trier's films is always that you can't ever get fully emotionally involved in it, because you can never quite get past that sarcastic tone. But there are things in Antichrist that are stylistically and tonally really, really terrific. There are things that are just like, oh, God, Lars, stop it. You know, Lars. And there are other things in it which are just a bit clunky, like, for example, doing the PhD on genocide, which was very interesting, that Willem Dafoe said. I just think it's a shorthand, in which case it's a very, very clunky shorthand. It is the film that's been written about by those tabloid scare stories, in as much as it is a film that wants to generate those tabloid scare stories. And as I said, anyone who's written those tabloid scare stories, pat yourselves on the back, because you are doing the job of publicising the film. I think
you've
it's
had
one
your
of
4 minutes, by the way. You've been rambling for about 10 now.
It's his best movie. It's his, you know, worst movie. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
I gave up
and over here
minutes.
Was another. And it is one of the. It's a movie that demonstrates that von Trier has talent.
Yes.
He is also incredibly annoying and slappable. Yes. And the fact that he keeps telling everyone he's really depressed, you know, hey, we're all really depressed sometimes, and sometimes we're not. But don't take it seriously. Trust the tale.
Or just don't
not
go and see it.
No, do go and
no,
see
don't
it.
Go and
no,
see
you
it.
Do. I think actually it's the most interesting film.
I was going to watch it. I was going to watch it, and then you told me not to. So I watched it.
Let me just correct that. You asked me whether you should.
No, I was watching it, and then you said, no, don't watch it. I've seen it. You won't like it. So I didn't.
You won't like it. No, but you wouldn't like it.
Well, why would I want
to? Well, actually, you know what? I take it back. I was wrong.
Right at the first five
I did
minutes.
You an injustice. I did you an injustice, and I apologise before the nation, Simon. I apologise. Go see Antichrist.
No.
You'll love it.
No.
No, honestly, the musical numbers are great.
I had the DVD. I chose not to watch it. Peter Allen.
I've seen it three times now.
Peter Allen is here because Drive's coming from the studio. Yeah. Just because.
Have you seen Antichrist, Peter?
Money.
No, it sounds like the end of a lovely relationship going on here.
Why would you go and see the Antichrist?
It's not the Antichrist. It's Antichrist.
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 You just accused your guest of rambling there. Your buddy. Your
he's
soulmate.
Not a guest.
Excuse me. Don't use the word
centre. The man who has made you famous over the years.
He was rambling. You asked for 4 minutes more on Lars von Trier, and he went on for about another 10.
Film of the week. Clearly, film
no,
of the week.
No, it's going to be the Sandra Bullock.
No, film of the week.
Our studio is broken, Simon. That's why we're here.
Hey, what?
Our studio is broken.
Okay, you.
It's rather careless. I've lost two co-presenters and a studio within the last half hour.
Mark and I could just carry on for a bit longer if you want to mend it.
Ask Mark another question.
Okay. Adam in Portadown, County Armagh. On holiday a couple of weeks ago, I went with my friend Wojtek to see Antichrist. I was certainly impressed with the film, perhaps most by the atmospheric and slightly shocking slow-mo prologue.
Yes, which is very fine, and the post-prologue bit as well, which is also slow and shocking.
Surely it's a film that has things to say, but these themes are pushed to the back of my mind, and I can't really help but thinking about the incredibly violent scenes near the end of the film.
Yeah, but they're symbolic.
This email from Derek of Tewkesbury, who sounds like a sort of historic character.
Yes, Derek of Tewkesbury.
Was written about by Shakespeare.
Actually, he should have been presenting that the Charles Dickens documentary with Derek Jacobi, who was making such a mess of it.
Derek of Tewkesbury says, the film Antichrist is another in a line of productions that deliberately assault decency and poison the imagination. Von Trier is clearly a talented filmmaker, but that is no excuse for making disgusting films. The best wall in the world deserves to be pulled down if it surrounds a concentration camp. I don't say I have not seen it, so I have not, so I cannot comment.
Yeah, well,
I have never seen. Oh, okay.
No, there we go. It's like, thank you. You know, I'm going to be quite clear about this. The "I haven't seen it, but" argument is cutting no mustard around here.
So let's allow a certain time for the Sandra Bullock rom-com of the week.
Okay, shall award. I do it? Have we got a minute?
Well, for the overwhelming majority of the people listening who have no intention of going to see Antichrist.
Fine. So here we go. Sandra Bullock's got a new movie out, right? I like Sandra Bullock. Always have liked Sandra Bullock. Seems very nice, very likeable, very personable. So anyway, new Sandra Bullock movie is out, okay? Which is always something you approach with a heavy heart because it's, don't let me down again, don't let me down again, you've let me down again. So the story is Sandra Bullock is a boss, right? She's really, really tough, yeah? But she's Canadian and she hasn't filled out the passport application, so by some ludicrous plot machination, she's going to be deported back to Canada, unless she can marry an American. So suddenly her underling, her bloke, you know, Ryan Thingy Bob, she says, I'm going to marry him, right? So then, in order for the marriage to look proper, they have to go through that process of pretending to know about each other so it doesn't look like a paper. It's exactly the same plot of Green Card, of Paper Wedding, of, to some extent, Leave to Remain even. Anyway, here's a clip. Stop me if you've heard this one before.
So, have the two of you told your parents about your secret love?
Oh, impossible. My parents are dead. No brothers or sisters either. So.
Gone. Yeah. What, are your parents dead?
Oh, no, his are very much alive.
Very much.
We were going to tell them this weekend. Gammy's 90th birthday, and the whole family's coming together, and we thought it'd be a nice surprise.
And where is this surprise going to take place?
At Andrew's parents' house.
Where is that located again?
Why am I doing all the talking? It's your parents' house. Why don't you tell them where it is? Jump in.
Sitka. Alaska. You're going to go to Alaska this weekend?
Yeah. Yes. We are going to Alaska. That's where my Andrew's from.
If you remember the poster for Green Card, the tagline was, they married, they met, they fell in love. Well, yeah. There you go. That's the proposal. Don't want to give the ending away. Horcruxes turn up. And it's just hard because the thing with Sandra Bullock is you so much want her to do good work, and every now and then something comes along like Crash, and you think, oh, great, you know. But most of the time, it's like being a Richard Gere fan. I mean, I wear my Richard Gere fandom like a kind of a yoke of depression. I mean, you know, Lars von Trier's depressed, right? You try being a Richard Gere fan, Lars, seriously. You drag yourself along, each new thing comes up starring Richard Gere, and he just does the Mr. Blinky performance that he's done in every other film, and he lets you down all over again. And Sandra Bullock, you know, she's charming and nice and apparently very pleasant. I remember when the war was on last time and she was the force's sweetheart, and there's nothing to dislike about her except for the fact that the films she makes are just such consistent dogs.
Andrew in Reading. Dear Kirk and Spock, just back from seeing the proposal, was fairly happy with it. Lots of reaction, body language, jokes funnier than
body language.
Okay, it's no 2 weeks' notice, and Sandra is much more horrible in Crash, but all in all, a good little film. I could have done with another 30 minutes instead of the end of film interview clips, but that's just me, 7 out of 10. And there is the voice of Middle England.
Yeah, that unfortunately is called the lowering of standards, that we've all got so used to Sandra Bullock making very bad movies that when she makes something that's even half passable. Incidentally, you've seen the trailer, right?
What, for the proposal?
Yeah.
I've seen the poster. That's
Ryan
all I've done.
The trailer in Ryan Reynolds and she run into each other naked. That's it. That's the gag. They run into each other naked.
Well, I can think of worse trailers.
Really? Have you seen the trailer for Antichrist?
No, I haven't. Which do you fancy, Peter? Which would you rather
see? I think I'll probably go in for the running into someone naked.
A bit of Sandra Bullock, yeah. Definitely.
One sentence review of Antichrist. If you don't laugh at the fox, you're with me.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.